Hello, and welcome to I Am The Egg Pod, with me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, I'm joined by author, TV and radio presenter, and a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature, Tom Holland.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you so much.
Thank you for coming. I'm a big fan, I have to say. I'm not going to get all gushy, but yes, your book, Dominion, The Making of the Western Mind, it's in paperback now, isn't it?
Yes, available from all good bookshops.
But none of the bad ones.
None of the bad ones, no. And it's got the Beatles on the cover.
I know. You're arguing that most of our assumptions and values in the West derive from Christianity. And somehow you've managed to cover 2,500 years, is that right?
Yes. So I mean, mostly I write about the ancient world.
Yes.
And I think up until I wrote Dominion, the most recent thing I'd written about was the First Crusade. Wow. So the likelihood of getting to write about the Beatles was fairly limited. But yeah, as you say, the thesis of the book is that essentially we are, as it were, shaved fish. Swimming in a goldfish bowl, and that the water that we're swimming in is Christian. We don't even realize it. And I take that thesis right the way back from the ancient Greeks up to the present day. And the penultimate chapter opens with the Beatles recording All You Need Is Love. And the chapter, yes, is called Love. And it's about, essentially, the thesis is that that in the 60s, overtly Christian doctrines that you saw with, say, Martin Luther King, who was, you know, much admired by the Beatles, kind of mutates and it slips the moorings of traditional Christianity. And of course, John Lennon is, you know, one of the most famous things that he says is that they're bigger than Jesus. But in a way, they're kind of replacing Jesus. And so that's kind of that's the argument that I'm making in the book. And it was fantastic to be able to write a whole section on the Beatles.
I know. We were just saying before we recorded this that Ringo slipped in there very nicely.
Yeah, so the chapter begins with the Beatles in Abbey Road in 1967, and it ends with the Islamic State and the so-called Beatles, the people, yeah, who took the hostages, and Ringo was incredibly upset by this, unsurprisingly, and said, "This isn't at all what we were about," as if it needed saying. You know, we were about peace, we were about love. And I remember reading that when he said it, I think it was in the Evening Standard, and I saved that copy of the newspaper just on because I was already thinking about writing Dominion and was hoping to write about the Beatles. And so was able to use that line. So it sort of begins with the Beatles singing about love, and it ends with Ringo standing up for love in the face of atrocity.
So, Tom, when did you first discover the Beatles?
I can barely remember. They were so much a part of my life. I know that my younger brother got into them first. And weirdly, one of the things that got us into... We had the red and the blue albums. I think my parents had them. So they were just kind of... we knew them right from the beginning. But then he out of the local library... He got a collection of Mersey Beat articles about the Beatles and the Mersey Beat scene and all that kind of thing. Mm. For some reason, we both got completely obsessed by it. So we knew all about the beginnings of the Beatles. And then from that, it served as a kind of launch pad into going through their albums. But I think because we began with... with the early days, it meant that we followed them through very chronologically. And I remember it was kind of like we didn't want to get to Abbey Road or Let It Be because it would mean that they'd broken up.
Yeah.
So to begin with, we were young, and I think when you're young, you tend to prefer the kind of early stuff. So we were much keener on the red than the blue album. And then as we slowly eased our way through actually buying the album step by step... And we got to Revolver, and then Sergeant Pepper felt like a great leap, and we were really unsure about how to do that. And then, of course, as though we were hippies in '67, we just played it over and over and over. And then we found the White Album quite sinister, Revolution 9, all that kind of thing. And we discovered the whole thing about Paul McCartney being dead, and we were playing the record backwards, and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And then finally, we got to Abbey Road and to Let It Be, and it was you know, quite upsetting knowing what's going to come. And so we never actually, it took us a long time before we took the leap to actually buy solo stuff.
Yeah, there's a distinct point in your life, I think, where you take that jump.
Well, I'll tell you what it was like. So as a child, my three obsessions were dinosaurs, ancient Rome, which is what I still write about, and the Beatles. And dinosaurs, there's obviously a cut-off point. You get, you know, you get Triceratops, you get T-Rex, then you get the cut-off point, and then they're gone. Yeah. And the Romans, you've got them, you know, brilliant, their Colosseum and legions and stuff, and then it all collapses and falls and goes.
Yeah.
And it felt a bit like that with the Beatles, that to go into the solo career would be like kind of, I don't know, reading a book about prehistoric mammals or about the Anglo-Saxons or something, to take that leap. And so actually the album we're talking about, Shaved Fish, was the first Beatles solo album that I bought. And I guess it's John Lennon's equivalent of the Red and the Blue album. It is the greatest hits, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we're doing this episode, obviously, what would have been John's 80th birthday.
Yeah.
And, Shaved Fish was a very unusual thing. I mean, it's the only compilation that was released in his lifetime, but he was hands-on, full-time. He compiled all the track listing, edited the album, often very brutally. And it's kind of as close as we'll get to a sort of John Lennon mixtape.
Yeah. And I think it was just after Sean got born.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like he was thinking ahead. He was going to sit down and watch the wheels go round.
Definitely.
So this is his kind of farewell, I guess.
Yeah. Well, it was post Lost Weekend. So he was reunited with Yoko. They were back at the Dakota. They just, as you say, just had Sean. And also John's immigration dispute had been resolved.
Yes,
so he had that weight off his mind. Then a few months after this, the EMI recording contract finished and he didn't bother to renew it. So he chose instead just to spend the next few years doing the house husband
baking bread. Yeah. Baking bread and
bringing up Sean.
Yeah. And so therefore there's a kind of valedictory quality to it.
Yes.
That you wouldn't get. I mean, you would never get Paul McCartney doing this. I can't remember when Wings Greatest comes out, but I mean, it's kind of later, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's when Wings are starting to implode, but Paul is never going to stop recording. Whereas for John to do it, it's kind of an amazing thing. And so it gives it, and especially in the context of what you know is going to happen 5 years later, of course, it gives it a real bittersweet quality.
Yeah, it's a very unusual compilation, as you say. And many of the songs, because the limitations of audio quality on albums at the time, a lot of them are severely edited.
Yeah.
They're the original single mixes as well, which are often different. So I'll do all the geeky bits.
Okay.
But it's a very unusual album, and I would highly suggest a lot of people, you know, if you can get hold of a vinyl copy, they're still out there, do so, because it's a unique, of all the hundreds, it seems, compilations are out at the moment. I'd recommend this one.
Two, one, two, three, four.
Prime example, track one, which is really a medley, and it's Give Peace a Chance and Cold Turkey, but it's a severe edit of Give Peace a Chance, 58 seconds straight into Cold Turkey. But let's start with Give Peace a Chance.
Yeah, so I remember when I bought it and I took the album out of the sleeve, and I'd been saying how kind of upset I was at the idea that this was no longer going to be a Beatles album. And The credit for Give Peace a Chance was Lennon McCartney.
Yeah.
So it was like, you know, one last link to the Beatles. It's very strange because I went through, I spent quite a lot of time thinking actually Give Peace a Chance is really short. as you say, it's only kind of about 50 seconds.
Yeah.
And it was a while before I actually heard the single version. So I'd always assumed that, you know, the fame of Give Peace a Chance, I thought, it's pretty impressive that it managed to become as famous and influential as it did, considering it only lasts about 50 seconds. Very, very impressive. And I'm not, you say you're going to do the geeky stuff. Why is it so short?
Because John edited the whole thing. And basically, if you went over a certain amount of time on a vinyl album, you would lose quality. So he was keeping it as tight as possible.
Oh, I keep.
And I think there's the, you know, the reprise at the end as well. I think it was trying to keep some sort of theme. But of all the songs, I'm not sure why that one.
Well, I suppose with Give Peace a Chance, once you've got the chorus, you've got the point of it, really, I guess. Yes. I mean, it's got that kind of anthemic quality, hasn't it? It just goes over and over again.
Yeah.
With the sort of baggism stuff and in between. Yeah. So I guess that works. What I now see with Give Peace a Chance is the way in which, particularly I think in Lennon's solo career, but it's already there with All You Need Is Love, is the way in which he recalibrates traditional Christian messages into these kind of progressive anthems.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's done it with All You Need Is Love. He's obviously going to do it with Imagine. But Give Peace a Chance, I mean, that's the kind of message you would get from a vicar. Give Peace a Chance, war is over. These are kind of the primal messages of Christianity. And it's kind of weird that John is looking like Jesus when he's recording it.
Yeah.
You know, he's got this kind of long beard and his hair and everything.
Yeah.
And I don't know how conscious that was. A bit, because then, of course, he goes on to do God on Plastic Ono Band. And, you know, Jesus is one of the things that he ceases to believe in. I just believe in me, Yoko and me. And it's that sense that he's jettisoned everything. It's all about the giving peace a chance is simultaneously about how he and Yoko have become kind of prophets.
Mm.
They're kind of amusing prophets. They're prophets who know that they're ridiculous. They're prophets who are deliberately kind of drawing attention to themselves as kind of public fools, if you like.
John the Baptist.
But they are giving themselves John the Baptist, yeah. But they're giving themselves a kind of prophetic voice. And they are given that prophetic status by the people who cover them. So you get all, you know, the response of it in the press, in the media and everything is what's going on. I think it was the Queen said, why have the Beatles gone strange? Yeah. I mean, I think quite a lot of Beatles fans at this point would say, why's John gone strange? And of course they blame it on Yoko.
Oh, of course.
And I was thinking when Harry and Meghan did their interview with the Standard about structural racism. Mm. And I was thinking, actually, they are the kind of modern John and Yoko. But even to make the comparison is to make you realise kind of how witty and dramatic the Bed-ins and the Bag-ins and the recording of Give Peace a Chance were. I mean, it was. And when you think about, there's something very Give Peace a Chance about the public mood at the moment, about making dramatic, almost flamboyant public statements, and the way that even members of the royal family are now doing it, and you do feel that John and Yoko were, you know, I mean, incredibly ahead of the time, kind of blazing this path that perhaps only now we're fully qualified to understand what it was that they were doing.
Yeah.
So I think Give Peace a Chance is an amazing song. And I regret that the first experience I had of it was so short.
Temperature's rising, fever is high, can't see no future.
And then the kind of gear crunching of going into Cold Turkey, which is a hard, hard song. I mean, so I listened to it again yesterday before doing this, and all this, and I just heard the stuff about Trump. So the idea of going down with bad COVID was very much in the news. And it's a kind of terrifying account of what it's like to suffer physically. I mean, it's obviously, you know, coming off heroin, but just as a description of what it's like to be very ill, it's a powerful, bruising, horrible song. And I'm not surprised it went down the charts because, you know, if you're a Beatles fan, and that's not really what you want, is it? Yeah. You know, sending back his MBE wasn't going to help him get that back up because it's a tough, tough song.
I mean, he originally introduced this to the Beatles he wanted this to be the next Beatles single, and both, unsurprisingly, Paul and George, you know, it's not really what the Beatles were about. And it's, in his own words, he said he never injected it. He said we sniffed it a little, but he kind of blamed the Beatles in some respects, and also Peter Brown, for not being that cool about he and Yoko. I suspect there might have been a bit of paranoia there. I don't think, you hear interviews, and I don't think it was that bad. But I think it was just general insecurity. He turned to heroin.
Well, what? I mean, all of the particularly Plastic Ono Band, but also How Do You Sleep and some of the stuff on Imagine, the sense of anger and bitterness and resentment is kind of explosive and makes so many of those songs as powerful as they are. And that's clearly part of what makes Cold Turkey so devastating a song, is that it's about suffering. But of course, it's about psychic and spiritual suffering as well as physical suffering. And it's the suffering of, I guess, of kind of breaking up with everything that you've been. It's kind of divorce, isn't it?
Yeah.
Giving up heroin is tough, and giving up the Beatles is tough.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You were saying this was the first album you bought. Can you remember your feelings hearing this at the time?
Pretty similar to my feelings on listening to Revolution 9, actually. Thinking, I'm not sure this is really fun. I'm going to listen to it. I'm going to force myself to, you know, because it is by John, so obviously I'm going to listen to it.
Yeah.
But I can't say that I enjoyed it.
I don't think John did either.
And I think that it kind of expressed the feelings that I felt about the Beatles breaking up. You know, as I say, this is the first album, first solo album that I listened to. I kind of thought, God, this is going to be as grim and tough as I imagined it would be. You know, this is kind of like the musical equivalent of the asteroid wiping out the dinosaurs. As I said, you know, this is bad news. This is not going to be fun. And then actually, things brighten up from that point on.
This is karma's gonna get you. Gonna knock you right on the head. You better get yourself together. Pretty soon you're gonna be dead.
So we move on to Instant Karma, brackets, We All Shine On.
Yes. And so this comes after the heroin agony of, and the kind of atonal quality with which Cold Turkey ends. And then suddenly you get this kind of drum beat, and it's fabulously upbeat song. Although, again, of course, there's a slight edge to it. Because Karma, of course, is all about, in a sense, as John is interpreting it, kind of about payback as well as about reward, and I guess that's a kind of edge that is pretty typical of, you know, his solo albums, certainly the early ones. But I remember listening to it the first time I listened to it and thinking, oh, thank God, John Lennon's back. He sounds slightly cheerier, and you can imagine Instant Karma as a Beatles track, I think.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, all the tracks we've heard so far were effectively released while the public assumed the Beatles were still going.
Yeah.
So it must have been a strange, especially for Paul, I think, because he must have been thinking, well, hold on a minute here, you know, John's...
Yeah.
It's okay releasing Two Virgins and Life with a Lion.
But Instant Karma.
It's a song. It's a proper song. And the whole thing, obviously, it was written and recorded on the 27th of January, 1970. 10 days later, it was released. That's how quick the whole thing was done. George Harrison was on it. He invited George to come on. John was saying he's fascinated by commercials and the idea of instant karma, the idea of instant coffee, presenting something instantaneously. think of the bands around in 70, people were spending years, because of the Beatles, Pepper, recording albums and concept albums. And John was, you know, he was heading in a completely direction. It was almost sort of punk attitudes.
And also, he'd shaved all his hair off by then, hadn't he?
He did.
So the video of it, he's you know, he's gone kind of back to basics there. So yeah. Again, there's a kind of idea of simplicity and punchiness to it.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, do we know what Paul's reaction was?
Around this time, he was up in Scotland working on McCartney. Because late 69, they'd had the meeting where effectively that was it, the Beatles are kaput. So they all kind of knew. I mean, there's new feelings now that maybe John, who instigated the I Want a Divorce, may have just been saying it just to get a bit of a reaction. Because he seemed quite shocked when Paul announced he was going to release McCartney. So I think this is him
flexing his muscles, or
could be, couldn't it?
Yeah.
There's John Yoakam, Phil Spector on here. He fills all over this, isn't he, with his warm sound?
Yeah, which I guess is another thing that Paul wouldn't have liked.
They were never the best of friends.
So by this point, has he heard the Phil Spector version of Long and Winding Road?
Who, Paul?
Yeah.
No, Paul wouldn't have heard it yet.
Okay, because it's a kind of forewarning of the horror that is to come. Well, I mean, I can't imagine Instant Karma done any other way. I think it's fantastic.
Oh, it's perfect.
I really like it.
Yeah. Klaus Voormann, who is just always there throughout the early part of the Beatles' solo career.
Yeah. Everything about Klaus Voormann is kind of great.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of interesting. It's so early on in the 70s. You know, it's right at the beginning, kind of what, a couple of weeks into the 70s. Mm. And you feel that the pattern of the Beatles' solo career being set there. Klaus Voormann, John and George have kind of formed an axis against Paul. It's you know, the patterns are being set that will run at least until, what, 74, 75?
Yeah. Thankfully, didn't last forever. And there's great, as you say, the footage on Top of the Pops, both John and Yoko with their haircut, and then Yoko's knitting, which is perfect. Perfect.
Yes.
That's what I love. You say all this, you know, doing the bed-in, the bag-ins. You know, there was three channels at the time on TV.
Yeah.
And this was being broadcast on primetime TV and whatever. And they were doing this purely avant-garde stuff.
Yeah, to the millions. And I think... They were kind of influencers. I mean, they were using the very limited, you know, as you say, kind of three TV channels or whatever, or the news or the music, the radio stations, in a way that I guess no one had ever used it before. Mm. And it was kind of mixed of agitprop, theatre, stand-up, kind of completely inimitable. And I the odd thing is that actually, I think that it's as the Beatles are breaking up and the kind of the first year after the breakup, I think it's funny and it's fresh and it's dynamic. I think that later on it becomes kind of slightly po-faced and earnest. And I think that it kind of affects the music that John's doing. I think that the humour goes and it becomes a little bit moralising in a way that, say, Give Peace a Chance is obviously moralising, but it's funny, it's clever, it's knowing, it's anthemic. I mean, we're coming on to Power to the People. I think Power to the People is kind of... not my favourite.
Power to the People. This was another Phil Spector production in March 71. This is Revolutionary John.
And he's literally saying Power to the People right on. I mean, he is so right on. And it's fine being right on, but when you know how self-aware and witty he is and how brilliantly he's kind of done this stuff before, it suddenly seemed... I find Power to the People kind of... And all that sometime in New York.
Yeah, somewhere in New York City, yeah.
Yeah, kind of, it's a bit serious.
Mm.
It's a bit kind of student politics.
I think the Beatles were often, they, you know, they started off from Me to You, She Loves You, it was all you and me. And then 67, it was more sort of we, you know, all you need is love, we're all in this together. And then I think this kind of era is we the people. And yeah. Then you're being told rather than welcomed.
But the thing is about it is that John Lennon is, you know, a millionaire. I mean, he's everyone knows it. He's amazingly rich. He's living in a mansion. So the whole power to the people stuff is problematic to that degree, because there's a slight whiff of hypocrisy about it, as there subsequently is with, say, the Imagine video, notoriously. The thing about Give Peace a Chance and all the other stuff is that he's deliberately using his fame. He's leveraging it in a way that, you know, he's making play with it. And I think that makes it much more effective, as, you know, because all the stuff he does with peace is kind of amazing. It's against the backdrop of the Vietnam War. Mm. He is giving a kind of a degree of muscle to the hippie message that no one else does anything comparable. And, you know, saying kind of blazes a path that people still to this day are following. Mm. But I think with Power to the People, you know, coming from a guy who lives in a gated mansion in Berkshire, it's a bit rich, I think. Literally a bit rich.
Yeah. I think with John, because it's difficult, because a lot of people hook on to particular Johns. I think there's hundreds of Johns. And there's a lot of people who hook on to his peace campaigns and his political protest campaigns. But the thing with John, he, by his own admission, he needed a father figure. He had the Maharishi, whoever he was with, he would hook on to for a few months or for a year or so, and then move on. Basically, what happened with this, he had an interview with political writers and activists, Tara Kelly and Robin Blackburn from the Red Mole newspaper, which was a Marxist newspaper. And they were effectively saying, you know, your previous protests, the bed-ins and the bag-ins, they're a bit passive, so you need some more direct action that'll be more effective. So they effectively, for that brief period, became his Maharishi. But John's quote was, we'd got a bit of a reputation for hanging out with the Cambridge Graduate School of Revolutionaries in the UK. They made us feel so guilty about not hating everyone who wasn't poor that I even wrote and recorded the rather embarrassing Power to the People 10 years too late. But we kept the royalties, of course.
So. You see, so that's the John we know and love.
Yeah.
The kind of cynicism, you can't keep the cynicism down. But yes, yeah. Of course, so that would make perfect sense, because, you know, the two versions of Revolution, you can count me in, you can count me out.
Yeah.
And I can imagine Tariq Ali kind of telling him off for that.
We'd better get it on right away on this version.
Yeah.
But again, John was saying he said it was written in the state of being asleep, and I just wanted to be loved by Tariq.
Yeah, okay, well, that's fair enough. That's fair enough.
But it happened a lot with John. He did get very passionate and then just move on.
Is this the time that he's writing Working Class Hero as well?
Just after, yeah.
Just after, so it's, which is, of course, a brilliant song.
Yes,
it is. Because there, the anger is personal.
It is, yeah. What are your thoughts? I know it's not on the album, but what are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts are that they should have put Working Class Hero on instead of Power to the People, because they're kind of, you know, slightly, they're making the same point, but Power to the People is just a slogan. It's, you know, everyone says that. It's, as you say, I mean, it's clearly come from Tariq Ali. Whereas Working Class Hero, I mean, although notoriously John Lennon was middle class, it's a coruscating song. Mm. It's a devastating, and it's as all the best early solo stuff from John is. It's incredibly autobiographical, and basically it's about him, and it's about taking all these ideas of class conflict and the suppression of the working masses by the rich, and making it not about the great global processes of Marxist history, but about John Lennon. and it's brilliantly better for it. So I would, if I was choosing his greatest hits from his first 5 years, I would definitely replace Power for People with Working Class Hero. But I guess they had to include all the singles and stuff, didn't he?
Move on to track 4, Mother, and this was released as a single in the US, and it's again on the Shaved Fish version. It's a composite of the mono single version with the opening bells of the album version, and it's also been shaved a little earlier. But what are your thoughts on this?
It's a song that completely measures up to the sepulchral tone of the funeral bell that introduces it, because if you haven't heard it, you hear this kind of terrifying clanging bell and you think, what the hell's this going to introduce? And then it introduces this devastating song full of agony and pain that is a kind, you know, it's Julia from the White Album cubed. And I didn't know about all the primal scream therapy and, you know, all that kind of stuff that he was going through. But I think it's his greatest song about being John Lennon. It's the rawest. It's the most brutally honest. It's a really devastating track. And when you then hear it in the context of the entire album, which it appears Plastigono Band, it seems even more powerful, I think, because you feel this is an album about what it is to be John Lennon at this moment, looking back over his past in a way that is simultaneously unbelievably self-indulgent, but incredibly raw. And so you don't mind the self-indulgence at all, because it's feeding into this absolutely stunning music that I think it's the most... Of all the Beatles albums, both with the Beatles and solo, I think Plastigono Band is the most upsetting and the most powerful and affecting. And it doesn't mean it's the easiest to listen to. It's not, you know, isn't the one that I would choose to have on a desert island, but it's really powerful. And obviously the loss of his mother was, and, you know, his very troubled relationship with his father is kind of at the heart of his own myth about himself. As he understood it, you know, it's really powerful. I mean, what you don't get, of course, is the John Lennon who bought Aunt Mimi a house in Bournemouth.
Yeah.
You know, because that John Lennon is still very much there.
Yes.
The John Lennon who was actually didn't spend his whole time agonising about his mother. Yeah. The John Lennon who kind of asked around and who was... friends with McCartney and everything. I mean, you don't get that John Lennon at all. It's all stripped away. It's just the misery and the despair. But he turns the misery and despair to such incredible ends that you sit there and you can't really complain that he's done it.
He would have been 30, and he's basically singing about his mother in the first verse, father in the second verse, and then he's learnt from that. First three children, don't do what I've done.
Yeah, and that's kind of devastating as well, because you know that this is where he's not being a good father to Julian, and yet you know it's kind of looking ahead, isn't it? As well, it's kind of, but because in that song he's looking ahead to the better relationship he will have with Julian later on, and definitely the relationship he'll have with Sean.
Mm.
So it's a, when you look at it in the context of the second half of the 70s and the life he leads, actually, again, it has this kind of... And I think that's the great thing about all the Beatles, but perhaps John especially, because he died the earliest of them, that you are dealing with myths as well as with men.
Yes.
And so Mother, in the myth of John Lennon, is an absolutely fundamental track. And it looks back, obviously, over his, you know, his upbringing, his childhood, his disappointment, his ambivalent relationship with his father. And it looks forward as well to the relationship that he's going to have, the kind of the mistreatment of Julian, and then the way he kind of redeems himself over the course of the 70s, both with Julian and obviously with Sean. So, you know, as a kind of waymark and the myth of John Lennon, it's very, very powerful.
Yeah. I think the saddest thing for me is every verse ends in, I've just got to tell you goodbye. So Mother, yeah, goodbye, Father, goodbye. And then it's the children line that really gets me.
Yeah.
I've just got to tell you goodbye. But the thing that compounds it, you know, end on that and it's kind of, wow, that was sad. And then he starts the primal scream, Mama, don't go, Daddy, come home.
Yeah. It's, and then doesn't he end with Three Blind Mice? Was that the end?
Oh,
of
no,
it?
That's My Mummy's Dead.
My Mummy's Dead, yes. So you got that one as well. Oh, God.
All together now.
Yeah. What about She Loves You? Come on.
So we end side one with one of two songs that John composed with the word woman in the title. Double Fantasy's Woman is one of them. This is the other one. Over to you.
Yes. Even when he wrote it, it was a pretty...
Yeah.
It was a title that lots of people had lots of issues with, and lots of radio stations refused to play it as a result. So I think it was his worst charting single in the States. Yeah. And now, of course, it, you know, it's an absolute no-no. Although it was Yoko's phrase, not his. So he's kind of ventriloquizing. So I suppose there's that to be said for it. And it's, you know, the kind of very feminist message, but in a slightly, I think... seems slightly awkward, maybe at this distance. I mean, whether it did at the time, I don't know.
I think it did.
I think it probably did. I think what kind of makes it even more awkward is that, you know, that talked about Phil Spector, and, you know, the Lost Weekend is beckoning. Yeah, and, you know, this guy who's standing up, being all right on about women's rights and complaining about women painting their face is about to go off and put tampons on his forehead and hang out with Harry Nilsson in strip clubs and things. And it's not a good look.
It loses some of its sincerity. I think, as you say, yeah, it was coined by Yoko back in 69, she did with Nova magazine. And Yoko was saying, when I went to London and got together with John, that was the biggest macho scene imaginable. And that's when I made the statement. And yeah, you can imagine, apart from lack of respect for women at the time, but also racism. So he actually started composing it in 69. There's some interesting demos. But I think...
Oh, right.
Yeah. A much slower song. But I think John's take on feminism was full on, but perhaps a little naive.
Because you see, I think it's when he's talking about... this is the track that is kind of the most Prince Harry for me.
Oh, okay.
You know, the slight feeling he hasn't quite got it. you know, he's basically following the trail of a woman who's much more tuned into this than he is, and he is kind of, I think, parroting a phrase, and I think he hasn't really, you know, all the kind of the peace stuff and the class stuff. I think, you know, you really feel he's thought about this, he's sorted through, he's speaking as himself. Feminism stuff, not entirely convinced. Where, I mean, he might, you know, after 5 years of being the house husband, might have a different perspective. But you know that this is, you know, what's coming. He's going to walk out on Yoko. He's going to go off and arse around in LA. You know, he's not going to behave like Jermaine Greer.
But then this is no different to his peace or his power to the people. It was a phase.
Yeah, but I think the peace stuff, it kind of mattered to him. And he'd thought it through, and it's his campaign, and it's his words with Yoko. Whereas with this, you feel it's Yoko's words, and in it, there's almost a kind of sense of the using the word that he's using, coming from Yoko, it's kind of fine. Whereas coming from him, it's much more awkward. And I don't think I don't know. Maybe I'm projecting the perspective of 2020 onto it, but I think that people have problems with it.
Even I think no. At the time, he was asking people, "Is this okay?" But then, you know, who are you surrounded? You're surrounded by yes men. Yeah, that's fine, John. I think there was a lot of good intentions, but a little naivety.
Yeah,
but nothing more really.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try.
Side two, we start with Imagine.
Yeah, which of course is the biggest of the lot, really, and is a song that features in Dominion. So and the reason it features in Dominion is that although it begins Imagine, there's no religion, no heaven above us. It's actually an incredibly religious and in a way specifically Christian song. Because it's written like a hymn, and the things that you're imagining are kind of essentially Christian ideals. And there's a brilliant irony about it, which is that John lived when he was with the Beatles on St. George's Hill, which is kind of gated community in Surrey. And back in the English Civil War, in 1649, after the execution of Charles I, a group of religious radicals settled on St. George's Hill and started digging it up. And they did this because they said that the earth is a common treasury for all. And this was crown land that the king had owned. And they're saying the king's gone. There should be no property. So imagine no property. Mm. Imagine that everyone can just move in and plant crops where they want to, and we can all live as one. Mm. And it didn't last long. You know, that's the way of things. They got evicted, and this community, which called themselves the Diggers, they kind of vanished. But the memory of them kind of remained and was kind of huge influence on a whole kind of strain of radical thinking, kind of proto-communist thinking. And so that's... that sense of St. George's Hill as a site where people had imagined no possessions and had kind of tried to live it. Mm. But when John is living there, it's a gated community and he's got a swimming pool and he's got a Rolls Royce. And the whole reason he's living there is that actually poor people can't get in. You know, there are gates to stop them doing that. And so, again, I think I'm much more alert to the risk of hypocrisy there than I was when I first heard it, and I kind of took it absolutely straight. And I think it's has this status now as the kind of ultimate atheist anthem, really. And one of the reasons that I find it so interesting from the historical point of view is that I think that there is a strain within Christianity that kind of logically leads to atheism. Because in a way, the whole thing about Christianity is that you're trying to purge superstition from the world. You're trying to say that worshipping idols, worshipping false gods, if you stop doing that, then you will attain peace, you will attain happiness. And in a sense, saying, well, there is no God at all, there is no heaven, there is no hell, is a kind of logical endpoint. And imagine is the most powerful expression of that. Having said, hypocrisy is a feature of the entire history of Christianity. So the fact that that John and Yoko recorded this in a 17th century mansion with huge grounds all around it, I mean, it's not a game killer. But I think it is it from the point of view of the history of Christianity as well as the history of the Beatles, it's a really totemic track, because this is the great hymn of atheism, the great celebration of atheism. And it's kind of amazing that he wrote that.
I love your quote in your book. He was saying, a decade later, when John Lennon was shot by a crazed admirer, he was mourned by his fans, not just as one half of the greatest songwriting partnership of the 20th century, but as a martyr.
Yes. I mean, and that was a key part of why people were so devastated. It wasn't just that they were mourning the Beatles and John himself, but they were mourning someone who they, who had spoken for peace and who had kind of imagined a world without violence, and then obviously to die. And the echo was also of Martin Luther King, who, had been overtly Christian, had overtly spoken of peace and love and brotherhood in overtly Christian terms, and then likewise had been assassinated. But what I go on to quote in that, after that sentence that you read, is something that Paul McCartney said, which was, nowadays everyone thinks of John as being kind of Martin Luther Lennon.
Yeah.
But basically, we knew him.
Yeah.
And we can't take this entirely seriously. Yeah. Which is the kind of genius thing about him, that he could he could record a song like Imagine and Give Peace a Chance, all these kind of incredible songs that really did speak for a generation and did channel really significant cultural trends, and yet at the same time he was still John Lennon who danced around with Paul McCartney on a bus in Liverpool. And it's that tension, I think, that makes him so fascinating, of, a cultural figure and so amazing an artist.
Yes, yeah. Do you remember where you were on the night of December the 8th? December the 9th for us over here.
I remember coming down and my parents saying that John Lennon's been killed. And I spent the whole day at school just in a daze. I basically sloped off school to listen to the radio, and I recorded all the radio, Radio One. And I've still got the tape somewhere. And it was the first time I heard Elton John's version of Lucy in the Sky of the Diamonds. Oh, okay. And there was it kind of went on all afternoon. And and then they said, okay, now we're coming to the end. But what we've got to remember is that one half of Lennon McCartney is dead, but we've still got the other half. And then, do you know the song they played to celebrate Paul McCartney still being alive? The Long and Winding Road.
Oh.
And,
well done.
I again, at the time, I didn't realise how ironic a choice that was. But now I just think, what were they thinking?
Yeah.
What were they thinking? But I was... it was my first experience of bereavement.
Yeah.
And I'd been listening to all the Andy Peebles stuff, all the interviews, got Double Fantasy, was totally geared up for, him coming back. And then, it's terrible. But against that, obviously it then meant that he was number one for kind of, years and years. And there was just wall-to-wall stuff about the Beatles everywhere I looked. Yeah. So there were upsides.
Yeah. I remember the Andy Peebles, because obviously Radio 1 I was listening at the time. I'm guessing we were similar kind of ages. And there was, they played, I think it was a preview of one of the Andy Peebles interviews where John was saying something, and we're looking forward to seeing you in 1981. We're talking about doing a tour. And I was asking my mum, can I was what, 8 or 9, and saying, can yeah. I go on my own to London to yeah. sit her? But also, I think my memory that evening coming home from school, exactly the same. I went to school, I was just dazed.
They showed Help.
They did show Help.
They showed Help. They and did. I'd never seen Help.
Yeah. I think there was the Annie Nightingale whistle test interview, which she talked about before, which was, they literally said, right, come on, Annie, you've got 3 hours to prepare for this. And I really remember that. I remember that more than yeah. Help. Because that was the first, if you think news at the time was very sort of Kenneth Kendall facts, no emotion whatsoever. And Annie Nightingale was just the first kind face and kind voice that you heard telling yeah. the story. But I remember going yeah. home after school, we had one of those big old radiograms and we had it on long wave. You had long wave, medium wave. I don't think we even had FM. And I was just scrolling from left to right, and it was just everywhere you went, whatever country, it's Lennon or the Beatles, bizarre, yeah. surreal.
Yeah, yeah. And we'll all be coming back, because I see that there's lots of programmes this week on the last days. And I imagine there'll be lots again come December.
Yeah.
So it will be,
yeah. Right, happier times. So track 2 on side 2, Whatever Gets You Through the Night, and a duet with Elton John released in October 74 and his only US number one.
Well, that leads in perfectly, doesn't it, from my first realisation that Elton had been a Lennon fan, because I hadn't heard Fame at that point, that he'd started pairing up with Elton John and with Bowie and with Nilsson and all these kind of people that actually, in a way, that was... So many of his best songs were, you know, it was like he was looking for a new McCartney.
Yeah.
You know, he kind of needed somebody of equal talent to kind of bounce off. So Whatever Gets You Through the Night, I mean, it's a very cheery song. I mean, I don't really have much more to say than, you know, I quite like it.
I love it. I love he said it was inspired by George McRae's Rock Your Baby, which right. I never would have guessed.
Oh, I didn't know that. Right, yeah.
And the title was from a late-night TV show about alcoholism, as May Pang once said. And they used to channel surf a lot, and he'd just pick up random phrases.
So this is another advert, is it?
Yeah, and he was watching the Reverend Ike, a famous evangelist, who was saying, let me tell you guys, it doesn't matter. It's whatever gets you through the night.
Well, there you go. It's another Christian thing, isn't it? I hadn't realised it's another Christian anthem.
There's another book in here, Tom. I can't hear it.
Yes, it's writing itself.
But, obviously Elton, he visited the studio while they were recording Walls and Bridges, and they had a little pact. If this single reaches number one, will you come on stage with me at New York's Madison Square Garden? Which he did, and that was the night John was reunited with Yoko after the Lost Weekend.
Oh, right.
One thing I will say, which I haven't mentioned before, of all of these songs... They're either listed under Plastic Ono Band, John Lennon Plastic Ono Band, and this one's under John Lennon and the Plastic Ono Nuclear Band.
Interesting.
So we come to the track 3 on side 2, and the first single to actually be released under the name John Lennon was from 1973, and that's Mind Games.
absolutely love Mind Games. Play it all the time. My children love it. It's probably the one that I play most of all the songs on this album. I just think it's kind of moving, profound, beautiful. I really love it. The opening is to die for.
Yeah, which was... I always thought that was the string section. That was his guitar. Just going...
Oh, it's so good. Yeah, so good. I don't know what mood he was when he wrote it. Do you know what the context was for when he was writing this?
Things weren't going great with Yoko.
Right.
It was just prior to their splitting up. But okay. it was originally composed back in 1970, and it was actually called Make Love, Not War. And
yeah, it has that feel. I mean, it feels like a Make Love, Not War. It's I think it's a really beautiful song. And the sentiments, you know, that kind of sentiment is perfectly appropriate to the music.
Mm.
I play it when I want to be kind of relaxed and cheered up and feel a bit mellow. It's I think it's a wonderful song.
Yeah, it's one of the first songs John's actually looking back. Because he said when it came out in the early 70s, everybody was saying, yeah, the 60s was a joke. It didn't mean anything. It's all love and peace and peaceniks. And peaceniks, they're idiots. And he was saying that he was trying to say, nah, just keep doing it. So he's still going back to... It's weird, he got through all the revolution and the power to the people, and then he just came back to the love,
peace and,
which they wanted.
Well, not all, but... not Charles Manson. But everyone else.
Well, he was a beach boy, wasn't he? Not a beach boy.
Yeah.
Track 4, Number 9, Dream.
Great song. Love it. He came to him in a dream, didn't it? So that's kind of, that's all it is. And Mei Pang is saying, John. Whispering, John, all the way through it. So there's a trace of The Lost Weekend. And it inspired the David Mitchell novel, Number 9, Dream.
Did it now? Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it did, yeah. Wow. So interesting from the biographical point of view, because it's a product of that kind of very distinctive period in his life where he wasn't with Yoko. And interesting for its role in the history of the contemporary British novel. So you get quite a lot of bang for your bucks with My Dream.
I mean, this is the second single from Wars and Bridges. As you say, it's very Beatly. Obviously, the use of Number 9, which we all know is...
Yeah.
His number.
Yes. And again, it's slightly more fun than the previous track to feature 9.
Oh. And he had a very good relationship with Paul at the time, and he, Paul and May would obviously meet up a few times. But for me, this sounds like he's singing about the Beatles, the actual lyrics, so long ago, was it just a dream? It seems to be more about the Beatles than it does perhaps Yoko, who wouldn't have been at the time.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Maybe, yeah. I had never thought of that, but yeah, I'm sure that's right. Because, of course, the thing about dreams is that they are articulating things that, you know, are coming from the subconscious. Mm. So maybe even John didn't realise it.
Well, everybody he'd met so far had let him down. Throughout his life, his mother, his father, Paul McCartney, Yoko, throughout that particular period, all of his... And he was just needed to be unrequitedly loved. Yeah. And understandably, if you're that kind of person that needs that, people are going to let you down. And it's weird that, for me, I might be wrong, but I think this lyric is about Paul and the Beatles more than it is about Yoko.
Well... I'm going to go and listen to it again the moment I stop this podcast and listen to it in that light. That's wonderful. Yeah. God, I must have heard it so many times and I never thought that, but of course you're right. It's so obvious. Why did I You know, sometimes you just miss things that are staring you in the face.
I might be wrong.
I don't think you are.
This was around the time he was producing Harry Nilsson's Pussycats album. And the melody of the So Long Ago was inspired by Jimmy Cliff's Many Rivers to Cross, which Harry Nilsson did a version of.
And on the Harry Nilsson, I mean, isn't he saying pussy the whole way through?
Well, yeah.
Was it pussy? Pussy.
Au bawakawa pussy pussy. That
I mean, that's what it sounds like when you... what's that?
Well, that was part of his dream that he had. He came
up with that
phrase.
That's what he's saying, and he's sticking to it.
Ray Ciccola, who was one of the engineers, his wife, Laurie Burton, she heard it, and she was saying, mate, you ain't going to get this on the radio. He keeps saying pussy. So I think they kind of got him to repronounce it pussy.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, well, that's sensible.
And oddly enough, going back with the number nine, throughout every recording of this, Ray Ciccola announced it, take nine.
Oh, brilliant, brilliant.
So this is Christmas, and what have you done? Another year over, and you won't just be gone. And so this is Christmas. I hope you have fun. The near and the dear ones, the old and the young.
So we end with another medley. First part is Happy Christmas, War is Over. And then we have Give Peace a Chance, Reprise. But let's start with Happy Christmas, War is Over. This is John and Yoko and the Plastic Ono Band with Harlem Community Choir.
I mean, with Imagine, the one that everybody knows, the solo career track that everybody knows, because it's part of that. Now That's What I Call Christmas One soundtrack that gets played in supermarkets and shopping centres. And so it's just kind of part of the background. And I think that... to have written a Christmas song like that is actually no mean feat, and it's one of the things that the Beatles never did. I don't think that Paul's attempt remotely measures up. I mean, you occasionally hear it, but it's kind of annoying.
Oh, Tom!
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm committing heresy there. But it, I mean, it's not up there. It's not up there with this one. And
No.
And I think that this is another example of John channeling his humour, his sense of fun, his ability to grab people's attention for a cause that he obviously believes in, and the message is war is over. And so every time, it's not just a Christmas message, it's a message about saying let's give peace a chance. But this is, I think, it's a track that's had a lot more airplay than Give Peace a Chance. And I think it's in terms of what it does, it's probably his most successful solo track. I mean, it's obviously not as kind of culturally influential as Imagine, say, but it's probably the one that most people are most familiar with, simply because it gets played every Christmas. It's up there with Slade and Alid Jones, and that's quite a kind of eclectic group of people to be with. Yeah. But, it's a feat,
Wombles,
isn't it? I don't think the Wombles are up there. It's the Pogues, Alid Jones, Slade, and this one, I guess, would be the classics. The ultimate, the ones that are always played. So that's quite a feat, I think, to be in that group.
Yeah, and I mean, lyrically, originally it was primarily about Vietnam. But it's transcendent.
Right, well, I don't think that would have got him the airplay.
But it's transcendent.
Be out there with 19.
Yeah. 19. It's weird how, there's a lot of songs about Vietnam that you don't hear so much now, but he wrote it so ambiguously that it has transcended that, and it's still, as you say.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful, beautiful sentiment, and completely at odds with kind of, around the Plastic Ono Band, Mother, all those kind of songs, Working Class Hero.
Yeah. And the other thing about it is, again, that the opening is brilliant. And I think that with Instant Karma and with Mind Games, and the openings of these songs are just fantastic. You hear them and you know this is going to be great.
Yeah. The opening was inspired by George Harrison's guitar refrain on Try Some, Buy Some, which has got a... But I think John may have also heard the Hollies, who did a version of Peter, Paul and Mary's Stew Ball. Have you heard the Stew Ball?
No.
Shall I play a bit now for you?
Yeah, please, yeah.
This one's about a racehorse. It's called Stew Ball.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah,
and so
okay.
On and so on.
That is verging into My Sweet Lord. my Sweet Lord territory. Yeah, I had no idea. But John's version is obviously better. It's much better about Christmas than it is about a racehorse.
Long Shot Kick the Bucket was another great racehorse song. And finally, I mean, it's not really a song. It's just a kind of fade out at the end of that. It's the Give Peace a Chance reprise, which was a live performance of... from the One-to-One concert. And 10 years before Ebony Ivory, we have a Stevie Wonder duet with a Beatle.
Yeah. It's interesting that, I mean, he bookends Give Peace a Chance, and really that's his message, isn't it? And that's what he is tuning out with. So he's saying, I'm off to the Dakota now to do my parenting. So this is my last word, is Give Peace a Chance. And that's how he leaves the fans. And that is, of course, the message that he'd want. And it's still the message that he would have wanted to leave, you know, in 1980. Yeah. And it's the message that's the slogan that people proclaim probably more than any other when he gets shot. Mm. So I think it's fitting.
Yeah. Overall, what does this compilation mean to you? And also, it's, you know, it would have been his 80th birthday. What does John Lennon mean to you?
Well, the album served as the introduction to not just to John's solo career, but to all the Beatles' solo career. So I remember it very vividly. So it's an album that's very personal to me, that I listened to a great deal, and it kind of opened up the way to his other stuff. Obviously, it exists in the context of what then happened in December 1980, and... The regret never really goes, does it? Because you think how many amazing tracks there are compressed on this in 5 years. He was just about to start again. What would he have done through the 80s, into the 90s, whatever? You know, there are two or three songs on Double Fantasy that are as good as anything he wrote. And actually, what's interesting also is that quite a few of Yoko's tracks are pretty good as well. So I think that the prognostications for the 80s were good. He clearly seemed happier. He would have come back to England. I think that would have been good for him. I think that, you know, so much of his music kind of played off his upbringing and his roots, that in a way to kind of reconnect with his roots would have really supercharged him. I also think that all everything that happened in the 80s, particularly around CND and the peace movement and Greenham Common and everything, I think he would have had a lot to say about that. I think he would have engaged him. I think he would have inspired him musically. So I can imagine that the 80s would have been John's decade. And you can't help regretting it. And I think that the great thing about the range of tracks on this album is that they do serve as a kind of gauge of how complex a character he was. You said that there were lots of John Lennons, and you get lots of John Lennons on this album. And you realise that, so with the Richard Curtis film about somebody discovering that the Beatles have never existed and he can just lift their music, it wouldn't work because it's the fusion of the music with the singers, with the personalities who are doing it. And with this album, you're not just getting music, you are getting a look into the soul, the heart, the mind, whatever you want to say, of a remarkable man. And of course, anyone who loves the Beatles cannot help but feel the rawness of what happened to John when he got shot. It's always a somber time, the anniversary of his death, every year, and will be especially this year, 40 years on.
Tom Holland, thank you so much.
Brilliant. Thanks so much for that. I really enjoyed doing that.